Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet and playwright Kathleen Kramer. Kramer's poems have appeared in various literary magazines and journals, including the Comstock Review, Passenger, and Tapestries. She has also published a chapbook called Inside the Stone. Her most recent collection is called Boiled Potato Blues, and in it she writes of generations of family and the world of Pennsylvania's coal mining country in which she grew up. Boiled Potato Blues was published by Vista Periodista, and Kramer's plays have also been performed regionally and in the Midwest and Canada, as well as at Ithaca's Kitchen Theater. And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish. Thank you for having me.
Now, much of your current collection is about your past and growing up in Pennsylvania's coal country. Tell us a little bit about that growing up.
Well, as I may have said to you when we were discussing this interview, it was Appalachia. But I don't think we ever thought of it as Appalachia. It was just home.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not until you leave that you look back and you say, wow, that was Appalachia, with all that might, imply. Hardworking people who were extraordinary in their ordinariness.
Mm.
People who lived difficult lives because of hard work and lack of resources, but people whose family and faith and work ethics just kept them on the path that they needed to be on,
mm-hmm.
in most cases. So the community was actually more thriving when I was growing up there than it is now,
mm.
because the coal mines have become exhausted pretty much. The clay that they took out both was in strip mining, and a number of the factories and so on that were there have moved on to other places.
Yeah.
So it's a little sad to go back there, but my heart still has a home there,
and I
still have family there, so that is...
Yeah. Well, you left at 19, and you said that you couldn't breathe.
That's right.
To tell us why a little girl that grew up in that and didn't know anything else felt that way.
I have no idea, but it was very, very strong, the feeling that I couldn't breathe, and I remember telling my mother, I have no one to talk to. And I think I just needed to have different experiences and reach out. And I think there was some spirit in it that was just prodding me to go on to something else.
Yeah.
And so I moved to Washington, D.C. and worked there for a number of years.
Yeah.
Which was wonderful. I loved Washington. It's such a beautiful city.
But so you weren't overwhelmed by going into the bigger world after living in this?
No, not really. I was so excited mm-hmm. by all the... Oh, just the beauty of the city, the wide streets, the trees, the government buildings, which were majestic.
And all the monuments.
And all the monuments. And the people who were, it was very cosmopolitan, obviously. We had a little apartment right at the head of Embassy Row.
Mm.
So just the people from all over the world that I met in one setting or another.
Yeah, you chose the right place to open yourself up to the wider world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, let's talk about the beginning of your focus on writing. You came to Ithaca about 18 years ago, and you joined a writing group.
Tell us
how that opened up your world as a writer.
A little ad, and I believe it was the Ithaca Times, that said, forming writing circles for women, and it was Irene Zahava, whom you may know.
Mm-hmm.
She's very well known in this community, and she does a wonderful job of freeing people from the censor that sits, these are her words, that censor that sits on your shoulder and says,
She says,
ignore it. Just keep your hand moving. And it was so liberating and so satisfying to work with Irene and the other people, who many of whom are still my dear friends from that group.
But what was it? What was the inclination that headed you in that direction of wanting to write?
I always liked to. I did well at it in high school and in the college that I had to that point. When I say did well, I mean that I enjoyed it, and it was usually acceptable to whoever was judging it at that point. But I remember I was thinking about this, anticipating this interview, and I was thinking, when did I first realize that I liked to write? And I remember many, many, many years ago as a child going across the road and behind my grandfather's house, who lived across the road from us, across a little creek that was at the end of his property, and up this big, wide hill, and sitting up there with a notebook or a pad and writing with the sky all around me and the clouds, drifting across that field and the cloud shadows. And I thought, yeah,
This is a poetic moment.
This is wonderful. I have no idea what I wrote, but I just remember the feeling that it had, that it gave me to do that.
Uh-huh. It's a different language, poetry is. How did you end up, you know, funneling some of your creativity and your thoughts and emotions into poetry rather than some other genre?
I guess I am drawn to metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
I know I am drawn to metaphor and simile and beauty, making beauty out of things that perhaps aren't beautiful. I studied art therapy for a short time. When we still lived on Long Island, I studied it in the city at the New School for Social Research. And one of the things that I learned there is about what the instructor called sublimation, that when you take something, and I'm sure you know this, you take something that may be beautiful, or it may be extremely painful, it may be ugly, and if you bring it through yourself and it comes out the other side as art, there's a tremendous amount of healing that goes on in addition to the power that that experience can give the work that you turn out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It can transform
right.
The person who's creating it, yeah.
And there was something about the economy of language in poetry, having to choose just the right word, the right phrase to say exactly what you want. I love words. I love vocabulary. And there is a kinship, I think, between writing poetry and writing plays. Because, again, you have to say just enough. You can't go on in an expository way,
mm-hmm.
Or your audience will sleep. So I think there's a relationship between those two.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. That's well put. Now, I want to have you read from Boiled Potato Blues. This is a very moving piece. This is one of the first poems that I've read of yours. It's called Penny Candy, Long Pants, and a Red Wagon. Tell us a bit about it before you read it.
Well, my family were and still are storytellers, especially my father. And he has a memory that is incredible. He remembers details. So this was a story that he told me, and I remember when he's told me this several times. I mean, as stories, they get better with the telling.
Mm.
You know, you need to hear them again, store them up, you know,
mm-hmm.
make them your own, I think. I remember he was well into his 70s, maybe close to 80, when he told me this story, when it really resonated for me that it was going to be something I wanted to write about. And I remember his chin trembling.
Mm.
At almost 80, he was telling me a story that still moved him immensely. So there was no way I couldn't write it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So do you want to read it?
I will read it.
We'll talk about it.
Yes. I brought it on larger paper so I can read a little better. Penny Candy, Long Pants, and a Red Wagon. When his father delivers him to the store, ushers him to the candy case with its display of gumdrops, licorice whips, peppermints, and taffy. The boy gazes, secretly chooses what he'll get, if any is offered. He doesn't hear the murmurs of the two men, turns in surprise when Mr. Fox, the storekeeper, calls him, by name, in a friendly voice he's never heard before. Mr. Fox talks and talks, promises candy every day, long pants, not knickers, and a red wagon, shiny, even in the weak light which seeps through the fly-specked windows. The storekeeper cinches his sales pitch. My sister and me, we're very lonely. The boy agrees to stay. He remembers 10 more mouths at home, 10 mouths still hungry after the table's cleared. Maybe he'll finally please his father. Soon, though, the candy makes his belly ache. The long pants never materialize, and he still wears the scratchy knickers, held fast around his skinny calves with jar rubbers. The red wagon bangs empty over the cracked sidewalk in front of the store. The boy imagines he can hear his brothers at play a few miles away, their shouts of, "Ollie, Ollie, in free!" At night, he cries himself to sleep. One Saturday after sundown, when Mr. Fox comes, washcloth and soap in hand, into the back room where the boy sits, forlorn, in the tin bathtub, the boy begins to cry. Will not stop until the storekeeper sends for the father and says, "Take him home." Years later, the boy, now an old man, remembers, "Mother and Dad let me come home again, and they weren't mad at me or anything."
That's great. What a moving story. I can see why you needed to hear that over and over again. Did your father get to hear you read this? Is he still alive?
He's still alive. He's 90 now.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I've read this to him.
Hmm.
I'm choosing not to share much of this with my immediate family.
Really? Oh.
I may at some point in the future, but you know how it is. If you have siblings, you see your lives differently.
Absolutely.
From each other.
Mm-hmm.
And what you remember is not what someone else's remembrance is. So I need to wait and think a little bit about it.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Huh. Now you described putting the book together as a crazy quilt kind of experience.
Yeah.
When you were writing all these poems, which you say took you about 10 years to collect,
right.
Did you know that this was going to become a book with a theme?
No, I didn't. The poems just seemed to insist on being written.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we all process our pasts in one way or another, and this was the way that I was able to do it. And so, you know, I would think, oh, I'm done with that now. I'm done with that time in my life. On to something else. But then somebody would wave his hand at me and say, wait, you forgot that story about, you know, Barney. You forgot about Barney. You forgot about Mr. Tom. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So they just insisted. And it was finally when I had a substantial number of them that they began to feel like they began to, again, think they wanted to be a book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of support from my poets group.
So you reached a point when you knew you were finished with it?
No.
No? Volume 2 coming out?
Well, I don't know if I'll go to that point, but things are still coming up.
Yeah.
You know, I just wrote a poem recently about pigs that my father and mother and I observed quite a few years ago, playing, sliding down a muddy bank into a little creek at the bottom of the little bank.
Uh-huh.
And they were having so much fun, and they took turns. I can you not write about pigs taking turns and squealing and having such a good time? Yeah,
yeah.
So just things, you know.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
The joy that animals have senses of humor, that they have fun.
Uh-huh. Going back to your experience with Irene and the women's group, have you found yourself censoring yourself at all in regard to these pasts that you're bringing to life again?
That's a hard question. I suppose I do unconsciously, perhaps. There are probably things that are off-limit, even within my own heart or memory or whatever, that I just am not ready to deal with and maybe won't be. But not generally, though.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say not generally. I think when you've done it for a while, it does free you, and particularly when you have a group, like I said, the High Noon Poets, who are so encouraging. We're so encouraging of each other, and it's a real gift.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to, they say, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet and playwright Kathleen Kramer. Now, I do want to have you read another piece from Boiled Potato Blues. This one's called Blue Law Days.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit about that one.
Well, I grew up in the late 40s and through the 50s, graduated high school in 1960. So at that time in Pennsylvania and a number of other states, I've since learned, there were things called blue laws, which in Pennsylvania were established, written into law in the 18th century. I was surprised that they had been that long.
Yeah.
And they basically prohibited retail sales on Sunday. And it could be stultifying when you're an emerging teenager.
I'll bet.
Not wanting to stay home, but not having any place to go either. So that's what this poem is about.
Ah, great.
Blue Law Days. If you put Sunday on a scale, it would weigh more than Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday combined. Even more than Monday, which carries rocks in its pockets on the way to school. If you stretch Sunday out, iron flat, the time wilting in the car while you wait for Dad to drive you to a morning of indigestible mass, if you unkink the moments helping Mom thicken the gravy, set the table, dry the dishes, it would be longer than the Friday you had a toothache and sat for hours in the dentist's office with nothing to read but a pamphlet on fluoride. While flies buzz and mother naps, while Ed Sullivan is still 8 hours away, you roam up and down Main Street with a straggle of friends. These are blue law days when nothing, not even a Coke at the drugstore, can be bought. So you lie on the overpass and throw pebbles at the sprouting tail fins of the 57 Chevys cruising below.
I love it. That's great. I wanted you to read it because it shows your sense of humor, too.
Thank you.
That's a fun one. I can almost see the sepia tones and and the dust of the past.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
Fascinating to me. Now tell us how you have also gotten into playwriting, and you say that it's somewhat the same language as poetry. Tell us about.
I didn't realize that about the language until some years after I'd been doing both. It actually, again, it harks back to Irene, and I had written a series of short stories there. There was a character who had emerged and asserted herself, and I kept writing about her because I found her very interesting. And some other people in my writing group, most especially Kit Wehner and Kajsa Wilmer, recognized, in their opinions, that these short stories could be combined together into a play.
Mm.
So that's what I did with their very gracious help. And it was done at the Kitchen Theater as part of the Kitchen Sink
series. Yeah.
Right. And so then Kit and Kajsa and a number of other very dear people had at that time just formed a group called Third Floor Productions, which was a women's playwriting and producing collective. And we had a studio on the Commons, and we met every other week, and we brought in our plays, and we critiqued them, and we decided sometimes to produce them, sometimes not. Sometimes they were short plays, and we did a whole, a show of 5 or 8 or 10 short plays, and sometimes we did full lengths, and it was very satisfying. So, you learn through that kind of a process, mm-hmm. from the ground up, and particularly with people who are more knowledgeable and very generous in sharing what they know and supportive. So
I've tried to write plays too, and I find it really difficult to convey everything through a voice,
mm-hmm.
and as at the same time develop a real person.
Right.
So how did you meet that challenge of turning this dialogue into real life?
Well, it started out, as I say, in this case, as more than dialogue because it was a short story. So the business was there.
Mm-hmm.
The description of what it looked like, what the room looked like. It started from a photograph that Irene had given of an old black telephone sitting in front of a window with rain spattering on the window.
Mm.
And it just went from there. And so, I knew what this woman looked like. They become real to you, the characters, don't you think?
Yeah.
And you think about sometimes you know that they won't say what you're trying to make them say. And then you get stuck and you have to go back and say, wait a minute. And you envision them, I think, in your mind, and not only what they look like, but how they would move, where they would sit.
And you have fights with them, too. I've heard playwrights say they have fights with their characters.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
I don't want to say that. Those kinds of fights.
Uh-huh. Right, exactly.
Oh, that's an amazing experience to me, because I have never been able to translate anything into a play. It seems too stilted for my language skills, I'm afraid.
Well, you never know. One of the things, too, that seems to help, at least for me, is to sometimes I start with a place, and I put people in it, and
so
they talk to each other.
Uh-huh.
And so that helps. That's my particular, it seems to work better for me. And also, again, having a group that will say, phew, are you kidding me?
Yeah, yeah.
This doesn't work. Well, they're kinder than that.
Maybe don't need to be, though, it sounds like. I want to ask you this, too. How has the experience been for you to, especially in regard to this book that has so much to do with your past, to bring this to life and go read it in front of strangers and share this emotion? Tell us how that has felt.
I've only done one full reading from the book, and this was done at Trumansburg at the public library there, uh-huh. the Ulysses Library. I have to step back. I also think I've done some acting,
mm-hmm.
and I think that helps. Because you kind of inhabit the poems in a way.
Yeah.
And you use some of the skills. And again, I'll mention Kit. I remember her directing me one time, and I thought of this when I was doing the play reading, the poetry reading, is to pull back a little bit and let the emotion come out a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are some skills involved in it. Plus, people love to hear stories.
Yeah, they
do.
And
because I happen to just like to write story poems, I think it helps. These poems, by and large, are not terribly abstract. There are some abstract poems among them, which I purposely wanted in there just to give it some air and kind of a different way to look
mm-hmm,
at things.
Mm-hmm.
Cave Fish, for example, is in there like that, and Gifts Given, Received. You wouldn't know that it was about one of my grandmothers, but it is.
Yeah.
So
you essentially look at it as a storyteller coming to tell stories instead of somebody who's been just sitting in a quiet room and feels vulnerable about, you know, showing people these parts of my past.
I think so. And you realize, too, as you tell these stories, people will come up to you afterwards or as you read these poems that are stories, will say, oh, that reminded me so much of... And people relate to it. And people are very, again, very generous and very accepting. They want us to succeed when we read in front of them. They want us to do well. And you can feel that.
Yeah.
So it's a lovely exchange.
Now, I do want to have you read another poem from Boiled Potato Blues. This one's called Standpoint. And tell us a little bit about this one, too. This one's somewhat amusing.
This, well, in the poem, it becomes quite clear that this is about my father.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably all I really need to say, because I think the poem really will tell it. And it starts, of course, in an early childhood and then moves into the recent past. So this is Standpoint. I sit on the linoleum floor, paw through the waxed paper in his lunch pail, looking for the jelly sandwich he always saves for me. Then, while he washes up at the kitchen sink, I eat the sandwich. Watch as he lathers his face, neck, arms, chest with ivory, washes away the day's coat of coal dust. Far above me, he sings, "You are my sunshine, my only sunshine." Turns and smiles down at me. I smile up with my jelly-smeared mouth. My daddy is tall. Or so I thought. Couldn't understand why his brothers called him Shorty. Until I grew to 5'5" and realized he and I stood eye to eye. At last, the reason for mother's flat-heeled shoes, even for dress, became clear, and why they rarely danced together, except in the kitchen to the radio. There's a tree in the meadow, and a stream drifting by. And why, 60 years later, Dad insists that mother trade seats with him for the reunion photo. There, in the front row, he hustles her out of her wheelchair and into his low lawn chair and takes her place in the wheelchair. He beams for the camera and for future great-great-grandchildren who may think he was disabled, but not short.
I love it. That's great. I want to bring this up, too, because you wrote this in your biography, that you're thinking of turning this book into a theater piece. Tell us about that. Has that evolved at all? Are you thinking in terms of Spoon River anthology kind of thing? Or?
Actually, that has been suggested, and that was the framework in which it was placed. I haven't progressed any further with it. I belong to another playwrights group in Syracuse called Armory Square Playhouse, and several of the people there have read the poems because they have very kindly purchased a copy of the book and have gotten back to me and said, you know, this really could work as a theater piece. And I believe that it probably could, because I realized when I did the reading in Trumansburg that it really was. Yeah, a theater piece. It could be a theater piece. It's a performance piece.
Yeah, a performance piece. I can see that the ghosts of these people are actually coming to life in these poems.
Yeah, thank
you. When you sang during this last one, that's when I started thinking of Spoon River.
Uh-huh, right, yeah. Right, yes.
Wow. So do you have any idea how you would have to change it? You'd have to develop the poems into more of a play, perhaps, like a dialogue.
I don't know. You know, I haven't really pursued that any further, and I do need to, I don't need to, but I would like to do that. I need to talk perhaps with this group in Syracuse or my friends here, you know, who were involved in Third Floor. I would need help to do it.
Yeah, it sounds like an interesting idea from this book. It's really a fascinating book, Kathleen, I must tell you.
Thank you.
I can see it as a theater piece.
Thank you.
You really bring these characters to life.
Thank you.
Out of the dust. Now, your husband Jack is a musician.
That's right.
And when we talk about rhythm and so on when we're talking about poetry and
yes.
writing, are you influenced by music?
Yes, I think so. I don't have the training, of course, that he does. I mean, he's an extremely well-trained and proficient musician, extreme sensitivity. He can listen to two or three notes of a recorded orchestra concert, and he knows from which country the orchestra.
Really?
He maintains that, you know, the French play differently than the British and differently from Americans and so on, and he's almost always right.
Wow.
So, yeah, he has an amazing ear for that. So he's a help to me. Does music influence me? In the way that you just heard, we were a singing family. Mm-hmm. My mother played piano, and we would stand. And I played a little as a young girl. We would stand around the upright piano and sing, you know, "Hand Me Down My Walking Cane," "I'm Leaving on the Midnight Train."
that's so great. So many families you hear about who were not rich. and didn't really have everything they needed, but they seemed to sing and tell stories.
Yes, and even today, now my mother is still alive as well. She's 89 now, and my mother has been blind for quite a few years, and she lives in a nursing home. But singing for her is just, it just brings her alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so every time we have a family gathering, my brother Neil, who is also a musician, brings his guitar, and we play, and he plays, and we sing. You know, they're in the nursing home. We use their conference room and have our parties, and the whole family sings, you know. Put your sweet lips a little closer to the foam.
That's such a great legacy to be able to carry it on for so many generations. God, that's amazing. Now, I think we have time for you to read one more from Boiled Potato Blues. This is called Travelin' Close.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to tell us a bit about it before you read it?
Yes. This is about my sister. My younger sister, Sue Ellen, who was 8 years younger than I, and she died in her early 40s. But before that, she had a very long and lingering residence in a nursing home because of a ruptured blood vessel. She had an AVM, arteriovenous malformation, which ruptured in her brain, mm-hmm. and it left her severely impaired for a long time. And so this is about her, but also about my brother Michael and I, who shopped for her clothing for her burial. Traveling clothes. "Buy something high-necked and long-sleeved," the mortician said, "and pink. It makes the skin appear warm." Her skin was still warm then, but each breath was bringing her closer to the cold. So we shopped, my brother and I, our footsteps silent in carpeted aisles between racks of clothing. The garments sighed as we fingered the fabrics, past first one, then another, left to right on the rack. "Pink was never her color," we said, noticing the past tense. We fled the store as we had been fleeing sick rooms for more than 4 years, while she, our younger sister, stayed behind, following us with a blown kiss and sightless eyes. Outside on the street, it was May, surprising us with life. We walked the small town sidewalk past red hydrants and blue hydrangeas, past peeling front porches and fading pansies. Then we saw the tulips, flower goblets on straight stems, tall, luminous, holding the white light of moon, of mother's milk, of dove's wing. Wordless, we turned, walked back to the store. And there were the tulips, transformed to creamy silk, high-necked, long-sleeved. We held in our hands the flow of moonlight, mother's milk, heard the whisper of dove's wing. "This will do," we said, understating our father's pronouncement. "It looks like something to wear to heaven."
That's great.
Thank
Beautiful
you.
Piece. Thank you. Well, Kathleen Kramer, we have run out of time here. Do you want to give some contact information so people can get in touch?
Sure. I'd be happy to give my email address.
Mm-hmm.
It's kkramer@twcny.rr.com.
That's great. Well, we will look forward to seeing you give readings in the coming months. And again, the book's called Boiled Potato Blues. Go get it. It's a beautiful collection of poetry. Thank you, Kathleen Kramer.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.